fire in the morning was 2,400 acres, and within, oh, probably 5 or 6 hours, it was at 24,000 acres.
High winds rapidly expand fires in the interior. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 5th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Eagle residents and volunteers work to build new homes by winter.
I'm quite confident we're going to achieve our goal here, and hopefully everybody will be snug as a bug in a rug by the end of September.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. The Alaska Public Radio Network, in cooperation with our member stations, provides the most complete, timely, and accessible source of Alaska news, current affairs, and cultural information.
Attorney General Daniel Sullivan today recommended largely procedural changes in the state's Executive Ethics Act to cut down on what have been called frivolous complaints against public officials. He told reporters that ethics legislation requires a balance of sometimes competing interests.
Those include confidentiality and a process that is fair to the subject of the complaint versus free speech rights, discouraging the bad faith use or abuse of an ethics act versus allowing the airing of citizens' legitimate concerns about their government, and perhaps most important, something that I think is extremely important with regard to the state's long-term interest, is the issue in the interest of holding government officials accountable versus encouraging public service and qualified citizens to serve in state government.
The recommendations in the form of an attorney general's opinion protect the confidential nature of ongoing ethics investigations, which would prevent the early release of interim reports to those who have filed those ethics complaints, keeping the entire process confidential. It would also require a complainant to pay legal fees for making complaints they know to be false. He also suggests the state defend accused executive branch employees or pay their legal fees if they are exonerated of charges. He says the law makes a legal presumption that state employees are acting legally and responsibly.
Most people act ethically, that they work hard. And I think sometimes we can lose sight of that, given that the headlines are the ones that are about supposed ethical violations, but the vast majority of people in state government are working hard and working ethically.
Some of the changes can be made administratively with new regulations the Attorney General can put in place. Sullivan says he will hold public hearings on those changes. However, most of the recommendations must be dealt with by the legislature, and they have already met a frosty reception. House Judiciary Chairman Jay Rahmer says he looks forward to hearing the ideas, but he does not expect any legislation to leave his committee during next year's session. He says the current law is only 2 years old, and most of the presumed abuse of it has come during the last year under what he calls sensational and supercharged circumstances.
I think in an ordinary environment, where, you know, it's just the state of Alaska examining itself, that most of what we have in place is very adequate. And I'd like to see the Executive Ethics Act in place under normal circumstances before we take valuable time, to reconsider how well it's working or to what extent it's failing.
Sullivan says his research on the Ethics Act began shortly after he was named to the position in June. Governor Sean Parnell asked him to expand the work when he took office last month. Heavy smoke is spreading over large areas of the interior as hot, dry weather allows wildfires to proliferate in the region. The first structures to be lost this summer to wildfires in Alaska were taken out by a blaze in the Fairbanks area. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Hard Luck Creek fire burned recreational cabins in the backcountry about 25 miles northwest of Fairbanks. State Information Officer Pete Buist says the fire is burning in an area along the Chattanooga River west of Murphy Dome that's scattered with cabins.
Unfortunately, we now have reports that three structures have been lost and probably about 30 are still considered threatened. Some of those are not in as bad shape as others. We've been able to do a lot of work in terms of setting up pumps and hose and sprinkler systems and that sort of thing. Others that are further from the river, it becomes a little more problematic.
The structures destroyed are described as a vacation home and two cabins. The Hardluck Creek fire is listed at 1,000 acres, but Bust estimates it's at least tripled in size.
With the weather that we're looking at and the extreme fire behavior, even at night, I think we're in this for the long haul.
Bust says heavy smoke has prevented accurate mapping of the fire, but that infrared scanning indicates the flames progressing in a southwesterly direction.
And that takes it out towards the Dunbar Trail and Minto Flats, which is far preferable than having the fire move up the hill towards Murphy Dome, towards the Goldstream Valley and Fairbanks itself.
Bust says an overhead management team from New Mexico and additional crews and equipment are being mobilized for the Hardluck Creek fire. There was another new wildfire in the Fairbanks area yesterday afternoon. Bust says the Otter Tail Creek fire, about 5 to 6 miles east of Chena Hot Springs Resort, received a heavy suppression response and has likely been held at 25 acres. The fire was one of a few new blazes that have broken out in the interior in recent days. Most of the fires are lightning-caused, but Fairbanks Area State Forestry has banned firewood and timber cutting due to the threat of equipment igniting new fires. A wildfire burning east of the park's highway made a big run on Tuesday, prompting a local evacuation recommendation. The Rex Creek Fire, 13 miles southeast of Anderson, surged ahead 7.5 miles in an hour. State Information Officer Mike McMillan says winds fueled the flames' rapid spread.
The fire in the morning was 2,400 acres, and within probably 5 or 6 hours, it was at 24,000 acres.
McMillan says a dry cold front that brought strong east winds pushed the fire northwest around Seven Mile Lake, where there are a number of structures. He says smoke jumpers and bulldozers were employed to protect the remote cabins, but the fire's aggressive advance prompted an evacuation notice to residents out ahead of the fire in the Windy Creek subdivision.
We don't know how many people are remaining in there. You know, we can't force people to leave. We just issue a recommendation so people won't be arrested or anything, but we're strongly advising them to leave.
McMillan says winds shifted to out of the west, and that should help slow the fire's advance toward the subdivision and the park's highway about 4 miles away. He says efforts are also in the works on the other side of the highway to keep the massive Minto Flats South Fire west of the Teclanika River and away from dozens of cabins. 520 people are working the Rail Belt Complex fires, which have burned over 500,000 acres. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Yukon River community of Eagle is working to get debris removed and new cabins built before winter weather begins and the road into Eagle closes for the season. Volunteers are working throughout the community, and volunteer coordinator Rob Pear says they could use more help. Pear is a volunteer from Pennsylvania-based Lightshine Ministries. He has been in Eagle since the first part of June and plans to stay till the end of September. He says 30 volunteers from Mennonite Disaster Services and Samaritan's Purse are working on building new cabins, and around 15 volunteers have arrived to help with debris removal.
So we're really working on two fronts here. The front that gets the most coverage are those 13 new houses. But there's a big behind-the-scenes effort to clear the debris and to make room for those houses. We had to brush the new lots off. We had to get gravel on those lots. And we had to get the city generally cleaned up. And so that's really what my volunteers are taking care of.
Pear says the City of Eagle has been given a permit to landfill old housing debris, and a company with a huge machine is on site grinding the waste into a less bulky mass to put in a prepared pit.
However, the people who are doing that contract, the contractor, is not going to go through and salvage material. And even though the homes were flood damaged, there's a lot of useful building material that was on the roofs and in the upper part of the homes that didn't get touched by the flood. And so we have our volunteers in there trying to harvest that material and to take those houses apart and set that material aside so it doesn't end up in the landfill.
Pear says the salvage material will be used to construct buildings such as smoke sheds and outhouses. He says ideally about 20 more volunteers per week would cycle through to help with the effort, but he says it's important that workers come equipped for the job.
I was just in a meeting last night where we were discussing the construction schedule, and we're kind of getting in a bit of a bind compared to the tools, to the number of people that we have on site. tools are at a real premium here. It's hard to get tools in.
He says beyond carpenters, there's a big need for those skilled in the mechanical trades like electricians and plumbers. Pierre says the BLM campground in Eagle is offering free campsites all summer for volunteers. He says volunteers should come with their own camping gear or RV, but the community is providing 3 hot meals each day and access to showers. Eagle resident Andy Basich is heading up the reconstruction plan for the city. He says they're making good progress. 5 homes in Eagle Village have roofs and 2 more homes are getting underway, as well as foundation and walls going up on others. There will be 13 homes built with FEMA funding, and they're on track for fall completion.
Certainly by the end of August, we should have every home dried in, so it's not a problem if we begin getting into a rainier season or the colder nights start coming in September. But I'm quite confident we're going to achieve our goal here, and hopefully everybody will be snug as a bug in a rug by the end of September.
Basich says beyond the need for volunteers, donations to help people who suffered loss but were not approved for FEMA money are also needed. You can find more information online at eaglecity.org or at our website, aprn.org. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the new Trident plant opens in Wrangell.
Right now, the primary focus is on pink salmon. We want to run up to 800,000 pounds a day in pink salmon.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation.
Conservation groups nationwide are hailing a federal appeals court ruling that reinstates a ban on road construction in more than 50 million acres of America's national forests. A 3-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals today overturned a 2005 Bush administration policy that allowed commercial activity in the nation's forests. Today's rule applies to the Chugach National Forest in south central Alaska and forests in the lower 48, but not to the Tongass in southeast. The decision reinstates the Clinton administration roadless rule that prohibited commercial logging, mining, and other development on the forests. The roadless rule originally included the Tongass, but court challenges and a Bush administration policy took it out. Earth Justice Attorney Tom Waldo calls the appeals court decision great news and hopes the Obama administration will end the Tongass exemption.
The reason it does not apply to the Tongass is that the lawsuit only challenged a 2005 decision by the Bush administration to repeal the entire roadless rule nationwide. The lawsuit did not specifically challenge the Tongass exemption. So when the court reinstated the roadless rule, the court reinstated it with the Tongass exemption still in place. Because of that, it's necessary at this point for the administration to end that temporary exemption by taking formal administrative action.
Alaska Forest Association Director Owen Graham says harvesting is so low on the Tongass that there should be no outrage over potential threats to the roadless areas of the southeast forest. That's because the U.S. Forest Service has approved harvesting on about 327,000 acres of the 9.5 million inventoried roadless areas of the Tongass. The Forest Service has decided to shut down some old logging roads in northern southeast. It's part of a larger effort to examine agency roads throughout the region. Subsistence and recreational hunters are most affected by the process. Timber cutters could also feel the impact. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
Old logging roads in the Tongass National Forest are being managed differently than they were a few years ago. Hoonah District Ranger Rich Jennings says that could affect people used to driving to their favorite hunting or berry-picking spots.
In the past, most all roads are open unless otherwise designated as closed, with signing and physical barriers and all that kind of stuff. But now with the new 2005 travel management rule, everything's going to be closed unless designated open.
So agency officials throughout Southeast are reviewing their roads and deciding what use they get and what shape they're in. Some openings and closures affect regular cars or trucks, while others impact off-road vehicles. Hoonah's Ranger District, for example, just decided to close about 25 miles of roads to highway vehicles. Michelle Putz of the Sitka Ranger District worked on the access and travel management plan.
in a lot of cases, there wasn't a lot of use of those roads in the first place. And for the most part, as we did the analysis, what we realized, too, was that, and what we worked on, was trying to make sure that we kept the roads open to people that need them for subsistence hunting and fishing and gathering. So we really worked hard to try to keep the roads open that people say they used and needed.
The plan keeps accessible off-road vehicle mileage about the same. Overall, about 163 miles of Hoonah District roads will remain open to vehicle use. Other roads were closed before the review started, largely due to their condition. Hoonah's plan takes effect in January when a new map noting openings and closures is published. Put says drivers need to take it seriously.
People are going to be expected to get a copy of this map at the district. It'll be free, or it'll be on the internet when it's ready. And people are going to be expected to actually pay attention to that, use it, and not go on the roads that they're, you know, not supposed to be on, that are not open to them.
Some of the closures are to protect drivers from collapsed bridges or other unsafe roadways. Others are to protect salmon streams. Hoonah District Ranger Rich Jennings says the Forest Service will post signs and in some cases physically block sections of closed roads. But the map is the main focus.
It's going to be largely an educational process with the public so everybody understands the basic rules and how we're implementing those. And then when time comes, and we're going to include the use of our law enforcement officers to help us with that.
Juneau's Ranger District is also working on a motorized vehicle access plan, which also includes Admiralty Island National Monument. The latest version would maintain about 33 miles for use, most in the Point Coverdon area, about 30 miles west of the capital city. It proposes closing another dozen miles of road to highway vehicles, most due to damaged bridges. Juneau District Ranger Pete Griffin says future repairs could return some of the roads to use.
We are looking at some bridge replacement in the Coverdon project area, primarily because some of our potential small sales that are of interest to local communities are located beyond those bridges.
Motorized vehicle plans are also in the works for Prince of Wales Island and Yakutat. Other ranger districts, such as Sitka and Ketchikan, have completed their reviews. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
After a few months of uncertainty, Wrangell officially became the newest home for Trident Seafoods in mid-April, bringing Trident's total number of plants in the state to 13. Trident took over the fish processing plant formerly owned by Wrangell Seafoods Incorporated. Since then, Trident's been busy making upgrades to the plant, and as of the end of July, processing fish. KSTK's Lisa Fu reports.
After managing processing vessels in Bristol Bay, Marty Jakes came to Wrangell in mid-July to become the plant manager for Trident Seafood's newest facility. When he arrived, work to the plant had already taken place and was still ongoing. Jakes describes the new additions and changes.
We brought in different types of equipment. There was a refrigeration system that had never been finished. We got that finished. That's going to be our primary freezing system. We put in RSW tanks for holding fish. We put a pump float over on the city dock. Basically, all the equipment's been changed out.
On July 21st, the plant started processing fish, heading, gutting, and freezing before shipping the fish out. Trident Seafoods has one main focus in Wrangell so far.
Right now, the primary focus is on pink salmon. We've also been doing chums, cohos, and sockeyes as they've been coming in on the tenders, but our primary focus is pinks. We want to run up to 800,000 pounds a day in pink salmon.
Trident had hoped to get at least 1.5 million pounds of pinks from a two-day opening, says Jakes. But as of Monday, the plant had processed in total a little over 1 million pounds. For the season overall, they're hoping for 10 million. Jakes says it's unknown right now whether or not Trident plans to expand their focus in Wrangell. With two plants in Ketchikan and one in Petersburg, Jake says Trident will have to figure out the best use for all of them.
We've got to wait till this season's over and see how the plant worked. We have to look at forecasts for Southeast next year. Right now, we're just focused on this year, and we'll see. I mean, we'd like to expand what the plant does, but we'll work on that this fall.
Trident currently has 160 employees in the Wrangell plant and has been working with many local contractors and businesses to ensure a smooth beginning.
it's actually been a great startup. A lot of good people came in and got the plant ready. It's a very simple line. It's a very simple system, but we've had very few problems. So the company's excited to be in Wrangell, and the community's been great so far, a lot of support, and we're just going to try to keep the plant busy as best we can.
For this year, Jake says Trident will continue to run the plant as long as the pinks keep coming in, which he anticipates will be to the end of August. In Wrangell, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
One of Western Alaska's six community development quota groups has approved a $15 million outlay for the region to tackle the chronic high costs of energy in the bush. KNOM's Paul Korchin has more.
Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation gains much of its income through shares in the lucrative Bering Sea pollock and crab fisheries. Last week, the NSEDC Board of Directors voted unanimously to take some of those profits and create a community energy fund, granting each of its 15 member towns and villages up to $1 million for improving their energy efficiency. Board member Don Stiles of Nome formally introduced the motion. He said the new fund would build upon one of NSEDC's already approved projects.
Mirroring what was already provided to Unocleet for their wind turbine project, the idea is to lower the cost of energy within the region.
The money can be used for anything from alternative and renewable energy initiatives to upgrading existing power and distribution systems. Precisely how it gets spent will be left largely up to the individual communities.
I don't anticipate a lot of oversight for this. I think what has to be accomplished is a plan has to be put in place in order for the money to be spent. So it could be, you know, down the road 1 or 2 years, maybe even 3 years before the money is drawn upon. But it gives a community something to look forward to as far as lowering the cost of energy.
The resolution says communities will have up to 5 years to tap into their shares of the fund. Before doing that, they'll have to provide NSEDC with a project feasibility study, an estimated budget, and a proposed timeline, among other assurances. The money has to be used to support long-term sustainable energy solutions, not merely short-term projects. The CDQ program was created in 1992 at the behest of former Senator Ted Stevens. It was designed to allow rural seaside communities to tap into large commercial fisheries on behalf of local economic development. As of mid-year, NSEDC's total assets stood at nearly $132 million. In Nome, I'm Paul Korchin.
Wind farms are going up in communities around Western Alaska. They bring with them the hope of cheaper electricity, but also the fear they might end up unused, like wind projects of years past. From KNOM in Nome, Jesse Zink reports.
In the Norton Sound region, new wind turbines are either under construction or in operation in Gamble, Savunga, Shaktulik, and Nome. That's in addition to numerous projects throughout the YK Delta. The latest community to be added to the list is Unalakleet, which broke ground on its 600-kilowatt farm in June. Unalakleet Valley Electric Cooperative General Manager Ike Tawarik says the turbine should offset about a quarter of the community's need for expensive diesel-generated electricity, and possibly more if a plant intertie with the heating system works as planned.
There might be some times when the turbines create more power than the town needs, and we might be able to heat our waste heat system that we have here that heats a school district.
Much of the money for the projects in Western Alaska comes from the state's new Renewable Energy Fund, established last year by the legislature. James Jensen is the Wind Energy Program Manager for the Alaska Energy Authority and has had a hand in many of the projects in the region. He says the surge in the number of projects should bring benefits of scale.
We've been excited about building a concentration of projects where hopefully operation and maintenance costs and even construction costs may drop with just the density of projects in the region. If you have to bring in specialists for any reason, you may be able to utilize them in multiple communities on multiple turbines rather than just have to fly in somebody from the East Coast for one turbine for one trip. It's hard to justify that cost.
Virtually all the wind projects in Western Alaska are using the same 100-kilowatt turbine manufactured by Northern Power Systems in Vermont. Clinton White from project developer STG has been involved in many of the wind projects in the region. He says the turbine was initially designed for use in Antarctica and is well-suited to Alaskan conditions.
These particular
typical machines don't have a gearbox, being a direct drive machine. So one of the advantages to them is a reduced operation and maintenance cost. They have tubular towers instead of lattice towers. The tubular design combined with the blade treatments that we use in these units do help reduce ice in certain applications. So they're very reliable. They're rugged machines.
Uniloclete put up a few turbines in 1980 that have long since fallen into disuse. And it's not the only community in the region that has dead turbines decorating the tundra. Jensen says more attention is being paid this time around to ensuring the projects outlive their initial startup period.
Many of the projects in the past had some old Jacobs wind turbines in it that were installed, and they were installed and then there was no plan to maintain them. Obviously, rural Alaska with sometimes limited resources and experience with wind wasn't able to maintain them without additional funding, and so those projects just collapsed.
Uniloclete's Tawarik says the new turbines are better designed to match the community's needs.
The old windmills were DC direct current producers, and it didn't match up with our AC system here in Uniloclete, so it was too hard getting the power converted to AC with that old technology. This new technology has been proven with use in Antarctica, and it's an AC system, AC generating wind turbine, so it'll match up with our power easily.
Tawarik says they hope to have the windmills in Uniloclete fully operational by the end of the year. Reporting from Nome, I'm Jesse Zink.
Summer in Fairbanks is being marred by dying willow leaves. The browned-out willows are the victim of a bug called a leaf blotch miner, which eats chlorophyll, killing the leafy portion of the tree. UAF professor of forest ecology Glenn Jude says the pest first appeared in the interior back in 1991 in the Yukon Flats and attacks thousands of acres of willows every summer across the broader region.
And definitely the Forest Health Survey reports have shown that the Fairbanks area has become, in the most recent years, the area where some of the most severe symptoms and extensive damage has occurred.
Jude says the leaf miner has a preference for about 10 of the more than 50 varieties of interior willows, choosing those with smooth leaves to which it can attach eggs. Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Integrated Pest Management Technician Diane Clausen says the overall regional infestation is getting larger.
This is the second summer we have seen it, but in 2007, willow leaf blotch miner activity was observed in Alaska on 91,863 acres, and that was nearly a fourfold increase over 2006.
The willow leaf miner has large annual population swings. The bug's outbreak is suspected to be tied to climate change. UAF's Jude says there has not been any specific research to prove it, but that warmer temperatures generally allow new pest species to get established. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rosemarie Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Lisa Fu in Wrangell, and Paul Korchin and Jesse Zink in Nome. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the new AT&T, your world delivered.
And by STEMS Floral Artistry and Gifts for Giving. STEMS in Anchorage at 563-3366. The Alaska Public Radio Network promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.